Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate 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 Vasudevaya.
Kuto nu tade De tava ishtat krita. Lobha deo ye buddhalinga bhava.
Lobha deo ye buddhalinga bhava.
Tathapidandam bhagavan vibhati.
Tathapidandam bhagavan vibhati.
Dhammasya gupta. Jai Kalanigrahaya.
Namasya Guptyai Kalanigrahaya.
Kandavija, are you going to read it?
Kuta.
Kuta.
How?
Nu.
Nu.
Certainly.
Tat.
Of that.
Of that.
Referring to the existence of the material body.
Hetava,
the causes.
Isha,
O Lord.
Tatkrita,
produced by one's connection with the material body.
Lova Adaya,
greed and so forth. Ye,
which?
Abuddha, of an ignorant person.
Lingabhava,
symptoms.
Tata api,
nevertheless.
Dandam,
punishment.
Bhagavan,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Vibharti,
wields.
Dharmasya,
of the principles of religion.
Guptyai,
for the protection.
Kala,
of wicked persons.
Nigrahaya,
for the chastisement. Now, just as a reminder, what's going on here before we read the translation is that Lord Indra is offering his prayers to Krishna. He is apologizing to Krishna, who is sitting where? Just at the base or foot of Govardhan Hill. And he's gone. Krishna has gone inspecting the hill to see what damage the thunderbolts of Indra have caused. But he's wandered off alone from his cowherd boyfriends to give Indra an opportunity to apologize privately, so Indra doesn't have to undergo any further embarrassment for what he has done. And what he has done is terrible. He's tried to kill all the residents of Vrindavan, so he's quite afraid. So he very, very humbly goes with Sarabi. Sarabi, the celestial cow, has come because Lord Brahma has advised, better take someone with you who's going to make Krishna's heart very soft. Because when Brahma committed his offense of stealing away the boys and the cows, and he offered his prayers of apology to Krishna, Krishna didn't even respond. He just looked at him. He didn't say one word in response. So Brahma could not tell whether Krishna had actually accepted his prayers or not. So therefore, when Indra came to him seeking advice what to do now, because he's understood by Krishna's lifting Govardhan Hill that Krishna is extraordinarily, unlimitedly powerful. So Brahma, so he's understood that, and he wants to apologize to Krishna, mostly out of fear of retaliation. So Brahma advised him, you take Sarabi with you, the celestial cow, because Krishna is Namo Brahmanya Devaya, Go Brahmanya Hita. He's so dear, he's so affectionate to the cows that certainly his heart will become very soft when he sees Sarabi, and therefore he will accept your apologies. So Indra came and he saw Krishna, and he approached Krishna, and with his effulgent helmet he touched the lotus feet of Krishna, and of course his head was in that helmet, so he was submitting himself before Krishna and begging for forgiveness. And this is the second of the prayers that he's offered. And the first one, he says that Krishna, I'll just read it. He says, your transcendental form, a manifestation of pure goodness, is undisturbed by change. It is shining with knowledge and devoid of passion and ignorance. Because Indra's act of retribution in attacking Krishna and the residents of Vrindavan was because Krishna had stopped the Indra Jagya. He had stopped the sacrifice which was traditionally performed for Indra's pleasure. And Krishna had stopped that. And why Krishna had stopped that? Of course, we know it was for Krishna's own reasons, and there were quite a few reasons in there. But Indra could not understand it, and he thought that Krishna, maybe we can make the sound going, he thought that Krishna was envious of him. He thought that Krishna was envious of him and did not desire that he receive the worship, and therefore he thought that Krishna was stopping the sacrifice. And as it is so often true, the bad qualities we see in others are actually our own qualities. So in fact, Krishna wasn't stopping it for that reason, obviously. But Indra was envious of Krishna, that Krishna had the nerve to stop my sacrifice. So here he's explaining in this fourth verse, that there are no material modes of material nature within Krishna's transcendental body. He is Vishuddha Sattva, Sattvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Sabditam. But he is completely transcendental. His body is not as our body is, and nor do the qualities that Krishna manifests, does it have anything to do with the qualities that we manifest. His attributes and qualities and his motivations are completely different. They are transcendental. They are beyond the modes of material nature. There is no goodness, passion, no ignorance. There is no pushings of these things within Krishna. So it is so important that we understand this, because this again is chapter 27, and chapter 28 is about Varuna and how Varuna kidnaps Nanda Maharaj. But starting in chapter 29 is the Rasa Lila section of Rasa Panchadhyaya, the five sections of the 10th canto, the five chapters of the 10th canto that deal with Krishna's most intimate exchanges with his most intimate devotees. So it is essential, before we enter into those chapters, into hearing those chapters, to understand that Krishna's motivation for interacting with his devotees in this way has nothing to do with a young boy, what would motivate him to dance with young girls in the middle of the night in the middle of a secluded forest. It has nothing to do with lust. It has nothing to do with passion. It has nothing to do with anything of this material world, because Krishna is completely transcendental. Transcendental means beyond. And what is Krishna beyond? It is, yes, the what? The modes of material nature, yes. Completely beyond. So what motivates Krishna to act in these ways, either by lifting Govardhan Hill, or dancing with the gopis, or stealing butter? We can define what motivates him in the negative, vyatare, by saying it is nothing to do with the modes of material nature. But what? How can we say what motivates Krishna to act in a positive way? It's actually bhakta vatsalya atma prajanta vidanyata. It is because he is bhakta vatsal. And especially his activities in Vrindavan are completely motivated by his desire to increase the ecstasy of his beloved devotees. This is what is motivating Krishna. When we act in this world, we act, what impels us is the modes of material nature. But it is because we lack something. That is what causes us to act, that impels us, forces us into action. We go to work because we want something. But Krishna, being the absolute truth, has no lacking. He is all inclusive. So what can motivate, inspire a person who is completely transcendental, the Supreme Person, the person whose universes emanate from his skin holes, that he has no lacking at all? What impels him to act? This is the great mystery of the Absolute Truth. What impels him to act? And it is the love for his devotees. So this first verse of Indra's prayers, which we read over the last few days, explains that there is nothing that Krishna does, or he's completely separate from the modes of material nature. So we should not mistake, as Indra previously has mistaken, and to think that Krishna's activities are ordinary. Indeed, they are extraordinary, beyond the ordinary. Ordinary means impelled by the three modes of material nature, because it is ordinary. That is what is going on in this material world. But Krishna's activities have nothing to do with that. They are on the Vasudeva platform. They are on the Vishuddhasattva platform. They are transcendental. So in the next verse, we'll read the translation right now. How then, has to do with, since you are transcendental to the modes of material nature, since the modes don't impel you to act, how then could there exist in you the symptoms of an ignorant person, such as greed, lust, anger, and envy, which are produced by one's previous involvement in material existence, and which cause one to become further entangled in material existence? So on one hand, by Lord Indra, his saying that Krishna is extraordinary, there is a warning in here for us who are within the modes of material nature, because they entangle us further. And Krishna has nothing to do with this at all. And yet, as the Supreme Lord, despite the fact that you have nothing to do with the modes of material nature, you impose punishment to protect religious principles and curb down the wicked. So the point he's making here is, so what is impelling you to act in the material world? What is your inspiration? What causes you what caused your chastisement of me, even in your own way? What you're saying, protecting religious principles and curbing the wicked. So please repeat. How then
could there exist in you
the symptoms of an ignorant person?
The symptoms of an ignorant person. such as greed, lust, anger, and envy, which are produced by one's previous involvement in material existence, and which cause one to become further entangled in material existence.
And yet,
as the Supreme Lord,
you impose punishment to protect
religious
principles
and curb down the wicked.
So we'll read the purport.
This complex philosophical statement by Indra may be analyzed as follows. In the first line of this verse, Kuto nata dekava ishatat krita, Indra refers to the main idea expressed at the end of the previous verse, namely, that the great currents of material existence, the forces of material existence, which are based on ignorance, cannot possibly exist within the Supreme Lord. Nothing to do with it. The word tadetava and tatkrita indicate that something causes the modes of material nature to manifest, and that they in turn become the cause of that which caused them. So we maybe could open the door, please. That an action that we make is caused by the modes of material nature, and that further entangles and increases the modes of material nature within us. In the second line of the verse, we find that it is material feelings such as greed, lust, envy, and anger that cause the modes of material nature to manifest, and that are themselves caused by the modes of material nature. So it is the feelings of greed, lust, and anger, etc., within us that impel our actions and cause the modes of material nature to push us along. And that causes the modes of material nature to further entangle the living entity. That which is caused by the modes of material nature causes the modes of material nature to act on the performer still further. The explanation of this seeming paradox is as follows. When the conditioned soul decides to associate with the material qualities, he becomes contaminated by those qualities. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 13:22, Karanam Guna Sangasya Sarasad Joni Janmashu. For example, in the presence of a seductive woman, a man may give in to his lower instincts and try to enjoy sex with her. By his deciding to associate with the lower qualities of nature, those qualities manifest in him very powerfully. He is overwhelmed with lust and driven to try again and again to satisfy his burning desire. Because his mind has been affected by lust, all that he does, thinks, and speaks will be influenced by his strong attachment to sex. In other words, by choosing to associate with the lusty qualities of nature, he has caused them to powerfully manifest within himself. And eventually, those lusty qualities themselves will cause him to accept another material body suitable for affairs governed by those qualities. So what an entanglement these modes of material nature are. And it is ultimately impelled, they are ultimately impelled by what? By this desire within us to be separate from Krishna, to not accept our position as servant of Krishna, and to try to lord it over the material energy, as exemplified in the verse quoted, Purusha Prakriti Stohi, the living entity situated in the material nature, Prakriti Sto, situated within the material nature, Bhunkte prakriti jani hai. He tries to enjoy the material nature. In the material nature, we try to enjoy the material nature. And the result isn't enjoyment, it's karanam, because of this tendency, because of this mood of I am the Ishwar, I am the Purusha, and I am meant to enjoy. This is all coming from a full sense of being independent of Krishna and thinking oneself the center, the enjoyer, Ishwaraham Aham Bhogi Siddham Madhavansuki. The result of that is not at all enjoyment. It's karanam gunasangasya, an attachment, an entanglement. The living entity becomes entangled and attached with the three modes of material nature because of this tendency to enjoy the misuse of freedom, to lord it over material nature. That is what false ego. That is what entangles us in the material world. That is what attaches us to the modes of material nature. And the result of that, sarasa joni janasu, then forced again and again and again into one birth after another, into one womb after another, taking birth and meeting good and evil and happiness and misery in the material world again and again and again and again. And the root of this is this desire to enjoy separately from Krishna. And therefore, the cure of this is Sharanagati, an acknowledgement that who am I? I am not the enjoyer of this material world. I am just simply and only a servant of the servant of the servants of Krishna. So this Sharanagati, or the return to our shelter, our natural shelter, because our sarup, our natural identity is Krishnan Nityadas. This is who we are. To define ourselves and to think of ourselves as anything other than the servant of Krishna is illusion. Even if we think of ourselves as eternal, as souls, as Brahman, Aham Brahmasmi, it is still an incomplete understanding of who we are. So the cure of the material disease is surrender of Sharanagati. And this is what Krishna ultimately prescribes in the end of all the verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Manmana bhava madbhato madhyaji mam namaskaru mamevyasmi satam te pratijane priyosime savadamam pratyaja mamekam sharanam raja ham tam savapapabhyo mokshishami masucha. Become situated in this Sharanam. You place yourself externally and internally as my servant, Krishna explains. In other words, you feel yourself, you think of yourself, I am Krishna's. How can I serve you, Krishna? And act in that way. And this reverses the material condition. But Maya will test. We say, I want to be a servant of Krishna, but Maya will say, oh really? Let's see. Let's see if you really want to be a servant of Krishna, or you actually are saying that, but are harboring within your heart some desires remaining to enjoy and control and exploit this material world. Let's see. So Maya will dangle in front of our eyes so many allurements. So many allurements. What do you actually want? So the purpose of this type of a testing, or let's see, isn't actually to give us trouble. But it the purpose of all assessment or testing is actually to give us an indication of what our strengths and weaknesses are in the educational system nowadays. The wrong emphasis is given for the testing and the assessments. It's as if it's for the teacher. It is for the teacher, but so that the teacher can understand how effective his teaching is going. And so the student can understand what he is missing in his understanding. So when we are presented with all the allurements of Maya, and Maya will test a devotee, an aspiring devotee, completely to allow him to understand what his weaknesses are, so that he can understand what the solution to those weaknesses are. And that we understand by hearing Shastra. What is the solution? So the basic solution, as we were just hearing, is the Sharanagati, or surrender. But that has to be to the core of our heart. So Srila Narottam Das Thakur says that prema bhakti, love of Krishna, which is the perfection of consciousness, is like gold purified in 100 flames. What is the meaning of that metaphor? The heart of a pure soul is like gold purified in 100 flames. When you purify gold, you heat it to an extremely high temperature, and then whatever is not pure gold rises to the top and it's taken off. And then it's cooled down. And then it's heated again to the high temperature. And then whatever is impure, not pure gold, it rises to the top and it is taken off. Again and again and again, the impurities are removed until one is actually qualified, free from the symptomatic modes of material nature, which means free from false ego. And one is devoid of the tendency to exploit the material nature. Because then and only then can we enter into Vrindavan. Because otherwise, if we have tendencies for lust, anger, and greed, when we see the activities of Krishna taking place, especially his dealings with the young gopis, the coward damsels, then our mind will think in an exploitive way. And we will misinterpret what is going on as in some way meant for our exploitation, and our minds will become disturbed. So much purification has to come, and complete sincerity ultimately has to be there. Complete sincerity means, what does sincerity mean? That there is no difference inside and outside. It's very hard to define it, actually. What does it mean? Yes.
It comes from the Latin word, which means without wax.
Yeah. Yes. Has that been ever confirmed? Do you know that? Any Latins here? And then the story is about the wax in the marble. No cheating tendency, we can say. So the easiest way to define sincerity is almost in the negative, what it isn't. There's no cheating. There's no hypocrisy. There's no
duplicity.
There is nothing other
than the desire to please Krishna. There is nothing in the consciousness other than only if Krishna is happy, then I am happy. That's all I care about. Like the one example is of Mother Yasoda, that it is said that she would shed gallons of blood, or she would do anything to save Krishna from one drop of perspiration coming from Krishna. She would do anything to save Krishna from the slightest inconvenience. That is love. That is love. That is purity. That is full sincerity. No conditions, like when you free giveaway, you enter this contest, you're going to win a free trip around the world, plus for you and all your family members. Then you read conditions apply, the little fine print, and the conditions are: first, you have to give them $700,000 or something or another. But in the case of Prema Bhakti, there's no conditions that apply. It is simply and only in every condition what will please Krishna. So this is love. This is pure sincerity. This is the natural consciousness of the soul. And this is the requirement to enter Vrindavan. This is the requirement to go to the spiritual world. No false ego. A full turning. Krishna bule se jeev. A full remembrance. Bule means what? Forget. Yes. Krishna bule se jeev. Forgetting Krishna. Anadiya bahimuk. Forever practically the soul has forgotten Krishna. He has turned his back on Krishna. Bahimuk. He has turned his face from Krishna. So it takes a full turning back to Krishna, which means fully accepting who we are in relationship with Krishna. Means servant. This is the basis of all the different rasas with Krishna. All the different relationships with Krishna are all based on complete serving, complete acknowledgement that Krishna is the object of my service. How can I please Krishna? How can I please Krishna? A complete existence in that consciousness with nothing else, no impurities or nothing else other than that. So that is what we are aspiring for. And Maya is presenting so many allurements is to show us how much we've progressed towards that goal and how much we need, we can say ultimately, all these allurements presented by Maya are to get us to understand how weak, tiny, insignificant we are. That Maya is so powerful. Daiviye shagunamayi mama maya dratya. That Maya's ability to allure me is so far beyond my ability to resist. Because here I am in the tight grip of the modes of material nature. I'm in Maya's kingdom. I'm in Maya's hand, in her tight grip. She's not letting me go. And therefore, from that, from the wishing to be a servant of Krishna so intensely, and seeing one's own incapacity to be a servant of Krishna, is born humility. And humility is the garland that Mahaprabhu recommends that the devotees constantly wear around their necks, because it gives one the ability, first of all, it is the opposite of material consciousness, and it gives one the ability to actually call out to Krishna for help and take shelter of Krishna. Because as long as we think that we have our own powers and we have our own ability, Maya will hold us tightly and say, oh, you're so powerful. Look at this. Look how powerful you are. You're so powerful. Ishwaraham. Aham bogi. This is demonic consciousness according to Krishna. Ishwara means what? Yeah, so as long as we can control things, then aham bogi. I can control, because if you can't control, you can't enjoy. So you have this ability, you're so wonderful, you have this ability, you have that ability, you can do this, you can do that. So you might as well enjoy. And here's a perfect opportunity for you to enjoy in Maya. And soon, as long as that tendency is even slightly there to enjoy, then Maya will grab that tendency and pull us along. So how deep the humility of a pure devotee is, complete. How deep the surrender of a pure devotee is complete. I'll continue reading here. The lower qualities, such as lust, greed, anger, and envy, are abuddha linga bhava. They are symptoms of ignorance. Indeed, as indicated by Srila Sridhar Swami in his commentary, the manifestation of the modes of nature is synonymous with the manifestation of a particular material body, because our body is basically controlled and is the modes of material nature. It is clearly explained throughout the Vedic literature that the conditioned soul receives a particular body, gives it up, and then accepts another, simply because of its involvement with the modes of nature. Karanam guna sangasya, from that verse. Thus, to say that one is participating in the modes of nature is to say that one is accepting particular types of bodies suitable for the particular material qualities one is involved with. An ignorant bystander might have simplistically interpreted Krishna's pastime of lifting Govardhan Hill as follows. The residents of Vrindavan were obliged by Vedic principles to make certain offerings to the god of heaven, Indra. So Krishna, ignoring the position of Indra, usurped these offerings and took them for his own pleasure. When Indra tried to punish Krishna and his associates, the Lord frustrated Indra's attempt, humiliated him, and exhausted his pride and resources. But this superficial interpretation is refuted in this verse. Here Lord Indra addresses Krishna as Bhagavan, indicating that he is not an ordinary child, but in fact God. Therefore Krishna's punishing Indra was part of his mission of protecting religious principles and curbing down the envious. It was not a display of material anger or of greed for the offerings meant for Indra. Sri Krishna is pure spiritual existence, and his simple, sublime desire is to engage all living beings in the perfect, blissful life of Krishna consciousness. Krishna's desire to make us Krishna conscious is not egoistical, since ultimately Krishna is everything, and Krishna consciousness is objectively the best consciousness. Lord Indra is really the humble servant of Krishna, a fact that he is now beginning to remember. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
We saw two examples when Brahma also offended Krishna, and now Indra is offending Krishna. So when they offend Krishna, they don't understand him to be the... They don't have correct knowledge of Krishna. But in the process of their lamentation, they are gaining knowledge of Krishna and they are offering prayer. So is that lamentation which reveals knowledge about Krishna?
Is it that their lamentation that reveals knowledge? Or is it, does lamentation
reveal knowledge.
Their lamentation about what wrong they did, that is revealing knowledge.
Rather, it allows the knowledge to manifest, rather than it specifically reveals it. Even when one understands, when they understood Krishna's position, that caused the lamentation, because then they experienced their own, their foolish pride, their foolish false pride, and that causes the lamentation. It's the knowledge that causes the lamentation, rather than the lamentation that causes the knowledge. Just, yes? Because what Indra thought himself very powerful and very proud, I'm king of heaven. But then when he got a glimpse of Krishna's power, he understood Krishna's position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then he lamented, look what I have done because of my pride, my arrogance, and thinking that I was so wonderful. Look what I have done. Look what I have done. All based on my pride. I'm so foolish.
How that knowledge is coming when they are offending Krishna?
But they're naturally Krishna. Both of them are devas. They are naturally Krishna's devotees. And Krishna will actually say this, I believe, at the end. Although you are my devotee, you have forgotten, and therefore I've done, removed the pride to let you again experience that you are my devotee. And yet Indra, as it turns out, he doesn't learn his lesson completely from this, because later on, later in Krishna's pastimes, when Krishna wants he returns. Krishna even gives the earrings of Aditi back. And what does he want in return? Not in return, but he wants a parijata. And Indra won't let him have it. So they have to fight again. So they are devotees already. Brahma knew that Krishna was his Lord, but he saw Krishna wandering around the fields of Vrindavan and playing, herding cows like an uneducated village boy. And he thought, how is it possible that he is my Lord? Let's test and see how powerful he is. So, and then he played his trick on Krishna, and then he got a glimpse of Krishna's power by Krishna's grace. And that when we lose our pride, immediately whatever devotion we have comes up again. It's the pride stops us from surrendering to Krishna, from being devoted to Krishna. One becomes humble, and then automatically one realizes how much one needs Krishna's help. Yes? I experience it all the time. And then how quickly the pride comes back and covers the... As soon as there is an opportunity, the pride is so great, so wonderful. Because not yet free from the three modes of material nature, not yet fully surrendered to Krishna, not yet understanding how dependent I am on Krishna. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
But if you're not the two, Lord Brahma and Lord Indra, it seems like, well, it's obvious that Lord Indra's appearance was more severe.
Yes.
But at the same time, it also seems like Krishna reciprocated with Indra more so.
Yes.
Because Brahma couldn't even realize, didn't know what Krishna was even thinking.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah. And just to say more about it, what did Brahma do? What was Brahma's offense? He
stole away the cows and the cowherd boys, and he put them asleep, made them sleep somewhere. In that sense, it was somewhat innocent. And what was Indra's offense? He tried to kill the residents of Vrindavan. So out of the two, which seems more extreme? Yeah. Obviously, Indra's offense, trying to kill all of Krishna's dear beloveds. And yet, as Chandrasekhar Prabhu was pointing out, that Krishna seemed to accept more pleased with Indra, and he didn't take his offense as seriously as Brahma. Yes, that's what he's saying. How is that? Why is that? So our acharyas have commented on this puzzle. And what's the answer? Who knows the answer?
Brahma.
Wait. Jagtini Mataji, you're going to say what the answer is?
That Brahma's offense was that he separated Krishna from his intimate cowherd friends. He pulled him apart.
He separated Krishna from his devotees.
And Indra's offense.
The result of that.
He didn't separate them, they all came together.
They all came together underneath Govanan Hill. And they had the opportunity just to stare at beautiful Krishna for 8 days. So in that sense, although superficially it appears that Indra's offense is even greater, it's actually less, because Krishna's most cherished desire is to be with his devotees. And even and as we heard, maybe it was at the farm, that even when Krishna responded to Brahma's offense, Brahma's activity, by expanding himself into so many cows and cowherd boys, each a duplicate practically of the original ones. And yet, while he was associating for that year with the cowherd boys and the cows, who were his own expansions, he was feeling separation from his actual friends and cowherd boys. So how deep is Krishna's love for his associates? Even by associating with his own expansions, he was missing his own cowherd boyfriends. So that is considered even worse than Indra's. Yeah.
Also, another interesting aspect is that during that period, according to some of the acharyas, that's the time when Krishna married the gopis, and also during that period of time.
Which period?
When the cows, that year when the cows and cowherd boys were in the cave. And also during that period, then the residents of Vrindavan, they were experiencing this love for what appeared to be their children, what appeared to be their cows, they had never experienced before. So it seems like, on the one hand, there's this separation, but for other residents, there's increased love during that period.
For other residents of Vrindavan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So, do we hear anywhere if Krishna did forgive Brahma?
Yeah. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. I don't remember the exact comment, but even by his not saying anything, there's a really wonderful comment. He accepted Brahma's prayers, and of course he did forgive him. And he said, later on you will have an opportunity to something. I can't remember what it was though, unfortunately. Does anyone remember what that comment of Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur causes? That shows how he actually, of course, did accept the prayers of Brahma. But he got Brahma very, very much on the mental platform. Has Krishna even heard what I'm saying? Krishna's mood was, why are you saying these things to me and glorifying me in this way? I'm just a coward boy. And indeed, that's Krishna's mood when he's in Vrindavan. Yes, so he did accept. But this is how the acharyas explain different things to make different points. From one angle you can look at it like this, and from another angle it appears to be this, so that the philosophy becomes fluffed out and still more wonderful and relishable, and producing more and more rasa. Because Krishna does many things with one act. By acting once, he accomplishes many of his purposes. Any other? Yeah.
We were talking about the modes of material nature impelling us based on our desire of being independent of Krishna, because of the greed and the lust.
Based on tendency to want to be enjoy, false ego.
That impels us. We hear that the devotee or the people who go into Brahmajyoti want to become one. That desire is also selfish, but then how do they escape the material modes of nature?
Well, there's many ways to look at this. One is that they don't, avasuddha buddhaya. They are liberated only in their mind, which seems to refer to those, the sadhakas. They think they are liberated, but actually they are not. They don't escape the modes of material nature. Krishna actually explains this in the Bhagavad Gita, that mogasya moga kamano moga jnana vachetasa. You know, those who do not accept my transcendental form, all their hopes for karma and jnana, all their knowledge is destroyed because of asurim, rakshasim, chaiva, because they have a demonic mentality. So actually, they don't get liberation. They have to come down again into the material world. Padam, 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 tata. They have to come again into the material world, into material consciousness. That's one way to look at it. And those who, if they're able to get to the Brahma Jyoti and stay there, that is considered by Prabodhananda Saraswati is worse than hell. So what they achieve is horrible, because it's lacking the sweet flavor of serving Krishna. So with avasuddha buddhaya, impure intelligence, they cannot actually gain liberation. Does that answer your question? Mogasya moga kamano moga jnana vachestata. Because of not accepting Krishna's form, that impurity, their jnana is ruined.
We do also because they have nothing to do when they are in the effulgence. So they have to follow.
Yeah. And because they're not qualified to be in the spiritual world, so they fall down to material activities. But worse than that is if they achieve it. Worse than falling down into the material world, at least there's a hope. But worse than that is achieving this Brahman effulgence and being stuck there. All it is basically is an absence of misery. It's compared in Shastra to deep sleep. There's dreaming sleep, and then there's deep sleep when you lose all awareness of everything. So that's their goal. And Krishna awards that goal, same thing, to demons that he kills. What does... So how is he going to... He's not going to give the same reward to those who love him so deeply. And Srila Sridhar Swami and his Rupa Goswami quotes... citation from Nectar Devotion, Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, who explains that if you take material happiness and you multiply it by a million or a million million, then you can get an idea of the pleasure that is available in Brahman. But if you take that pleasure and multiply it by a million, 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 and then a million, 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 and then a million, 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 that's like a one drop of the ocean of Bhava Bhakti. So therefore, Bhava Bhakti is moksha lagudakrit. It minimizes the value of liberation. And then Bhava Bhakti is like a sun ray compared to the sun of prema. So how many times, how many sun rays does it take to make prema, or make it a sun? So how much, so how unlimitedly, incredibly, unspeakably practical, practically speaking, ecstatic is the result of Mahaprabhu's mercy. And compared to, so Prabodhananda Saraswati Thakur says, kaivalyam nirakayate, he says it's like hell, this liberation, this impersonalist liberation, compares it to hell. So how wonderful this goal is. Okay, it's after nine. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaura Bhaktivinoda ki jai.